Hello and welcome to episode 116 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is a special episode about the Michigan Task Force on Jail and Pretrial Incarceration, whose recommendations have already resulted in 19 pieces of past legislation. First, I will interview Kamal Lucada Anderson about his life experience with driver's license suspensions in Michigan, and then I'll be talking with the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, Bridget McCormick, about the parts of the jail's task force recommendations that became active on October 1st, including the end of incarceration for driver's license suspensions, fines, and fees unrelated to reckless driving, and also what else we have to look forward to from the jail's task force in 2021. So often, task forces are where good ideas in the legislature go to die. So what happened in Michigan over the past few years was pretty significant and should serve as a model for other states trying to get criminal justice reform work done. Let's get to my interviews with Kamal Lucada Anderson and Chief Justice McCormick. Kamal Lucada Anderson is a lifetime resident of Detroit and a bus driver. He's 47 years old, and just 5 years ago, he got his driver's license back after experiencing years of being victimized by Michigan's driver's license suspension laws because he was unable to pay his tickets, fines, and fees, and for not showing up to court for fear of getting incarcerated. Last year, Kamal told his story of systematic despair to the Michigan jail and pretrial task force, which eventually led to his testifying to lawmakers about this very situation. This in turn played a vital role in convincing them to pass the bill to reclassify and to criminalize driver's license suspensions, and that went into effect today. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Kamal.
Hi, thank you, Joshua. Good to be on the show. I appreciate you.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. I always start my interviews with the same question. It's kind of the comic book origin story. How did you get from wherever you started to where you were talking to me here on the Decarceration Nation podcast? And you can talk about anything you want about in your previous life. Just how did you get from there to here?
Initially from the beginning, it started when I was a little bit younger. I was in my 20s. I'm 47 years old now. When I first got out on the road driving and things like that, and I started getting pulled over in the suburbs of Detroit for minor infractions, such as my tail light is out, or my muffler would be loud, or something like that. And when they would pull me over, I may not have proof of insurance or things like that. And that initially turned into a large fee that, once I wasn't able to pay, then it turned into a warrant, and that turned into a license suspension. And it eventually turned into a cycle of constantly being pulled over for minor infractions and that were non-reckless driving offenses, pretty much non-driving offenses, period. And eventually I ended up paying a lot of money in fees and fines. I ended up spending jail time for having my license suspended over the years. And I had my license suspended several times. And living in Detroit, you know, at that time, I was working in the suburbs, working in various factories. And because of the transit system here, because our transit system is not as massive as most major cities, it's pretty hard to get to employment in Detroit without having a vehicle. And also in Detroit, the insurance rates have always been sky high, automobile insurance rates. And so most Detroiters can't afford to keep insurance on their vehicles. And so I was kind of caught in a catch-22. And eventually, I got my license back, but I had to file bankrupt to get my driver's license back. And even after doing that, I got caught up with driver responsibility fees, which pretty much tax individuals for not being able to afford to pay the tickets that they already have. And so my license was resuspended again. And it led to me being able to tell my story. After I got my finally got my license back for good 5 years ago, I was able to tell my story to Congress in Michigan and be able to help in getting this law passed that is in effect today.
I think people assume that when folks don't pay their tickets, that must mean that they're horrible people or they've done something terrible or they're just irresponsible. But as you know, the charges build up pretty quickly and people don't always have the money necessary to pay the fines and fees, and they still need to get to work every day. So how did this, you told a little bit about this, but how was this kind of manifesting for you when it was, you were going through it on kind of an everyday in your life kind of way? What were you experiencing?
I experienced exactly what you said. I was pretty much looked down on as a horrible person. I was humiliated. It played a role in my marriage. I had a lot of issues in my marriage because of it, because I couldn't get certain jobs because there were jobs that require you to have a driver's license that wasn't driving jobs. It just wanted you to have a driver's license. And I lost jobs because they found out I didn't have a driver's license. I was disqualified from certain employment because of that. I lost jobs going to jail because of my driver's license suspensions. I pretty much it was just a humiliating, debilitating situation. I came out of a lot of money as well. You know, it went on my credit. I had the driver responsibility fees added up and went on my credit, you know, which was one of the reasons I was able to file bankrupt. So I, you know, it affected my credit, you know, and a lot of people don't know that that happens as well. And so you pretty much feel like you're a felon, you know, like you're a convict pretty much. You know, it's no different. And what I call it is, I consider it a poverty tax. And anybody that has dealt with the justice system in America knows that a lot of times it's not about right or wrong. It's about if you can afford justice, if you can afford to afford an attorney, if you can afford to pay the fines and fees. If you can't afford them, then, you know, you get the highest penalty possible.
Yeah, you testified at the task force hearing for the jails task force here in Michigan at Wayne State University. I was there too. What was that process like for you, and what would you tell other people about themselves getting involved in kind of those kind of fights to change the way our law works in over-policed and underserved communities in Michigan?
At that time, I saw an article in a paper that said that they were looking for people that had experience with having troubles with driver's suspension, with driver's license suspensions over the years. And that was right up my alley. When I saw that, I immediately caught the bus downtown to Wayne State Law School. I mean, I couldn't wait. I saw that and I was just like, it was like the circus was coming to town, or somebody
you
said,
you had a story to tell.
I couldn't wait. And so, because I never thought that I would be able to get that story out and try to get some changes made. But when I got down there and I saw all those people down there, I said to myself, oh, wow, they probably won't listen to my story. But when I got a chance to speak, it seemed like it really touched so many people. And that really touched me. It really kind of, you know, it touched my heart, because I never thought that not only would I be able to get my story out, but I never thought that it would touch so many people. But once I told my story and what I went through, I guess it was something that a lot of people just didn't know. They didn't know that so many people had been really held back in their lives simply because they couldn't afford to pay tickets and because they had suspended licenses. And so eventually testifying to Congress, that really, that felt good. Because to be able to talk to people that can make the changes And to see that they were all in terms of listening and wanting to take the steps to make the change, it really made me feel good. It was different from what I experienced over the last 25 years here in Michigan.
You know, I want to repeat this because I think people, even after hearing you talk about it, don't realize that what we're really talking about is driver's license suspensions that happen for things other than dangerous driving. And that's one of the biggest drivers of incarceration in Michigan. And we're talking on October 1st, 2021, and today is literally the day when the legislation that you're talking about, that we're talking about, passed to stop that practice. As a result of work that you've done, that I've done, that the Jails Task Force has done, that lots of people have done, we won't continue to suspend licenses for these kind of tickets. You know, this, I think, you know, you've already explained how this would have changed your life. And I mean, how excited are you to have been a part of this? And what do you think about it going forward?
I'm very excited, and the magnitude of where, you know, my involvement in it shows with all of the people around me who didn't know that I was involved in something to that extent. All of my, you know, my relatives, my friends, people, you know, people, my work colleagues, and, you know, just so many people have been calling me because they've, you know, seen that I've been associated with this new law that's been, you know, been shown on the. And so many people are excited because now I'm seeing so many people out of the woodwork that are dealing with suspended licenses right now, and they are being held back. So there, I mean, I've had people that have been excited, super, super excited, super happy. They've been thanking me for being a part of that process. And I understand, because I wish that someone was able to help be a part of a process back when I, you know, when I was going through it, that could help me get out of that situation at that time, which I never thought I would get through in this lifetime. So moving forward, I definitely look forward to being a part of the process of making sure that my voice is heard in speaking with lawmakers and speaking with law enforcement and speaking with community leaders and people all over the state of Michigan and just in America, period, to try to help make changes to keep poor and underprivileged people and financially and economically disadvantaged people from being predatorily, basically, you know, predatorily targeted in the justice system, because it's not just minor infractions. But we know, you know, it's major crimes as well that underprivileged people are targeted, and it, to me, it's predatory, you know, for them to do it that way, you know, the way the system is.
Yeah, I know. When I do a lot of interviews, I get a little frustrated sometimes, and when I see interviews with friends of mine and stuff like that, that so much of the interview ends up being about the negativity or things that we had done or about incarceration or about post-incarceration, that nobody ever really gets to know anybody. And so I want to make sure and give you a chance to, you know, what are some, you know, I just met you. Tell me some stuff about you that isn't related to all this, you know. Let us hear a little bit of your story, you know. Tell me about you.
Well, myself, like I said, I'm currently a bus driver, which ironically, the day that I went down and spoke down at the task force that day at Wayne State Law School, ironically, I had just started my job as a bus driver, and I had just gotten my CDL. And so that was something that I had been wanting for a long time. I always wanted the CDL, you know, I always wanted to be able to do that. So I'm a bus driver right now. I'm also an author. I do have a book out right now, and it's an urban novel. So I'm a writer. I definitely like to use my pen and write and express myself. I have a girlfriend and, you know, family and things, you know, and, you know, I'm just,
hold on. You got to say the name of the book, you know, I mean,
Oh, okay. The name, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. The name of the book is, it's called Legendary, and the subtitle is Detroit Mentality. And so it's Legendary Detroit Mentality, and that's a urban novel. And my middle name, Lucata, is what I go by as the author of that book. So it can be found on Amazon. And so, I appreciate the opportunity to put that out there.
Yeah, you got to plug your stuff, man.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Joshua. And pretty much, you know, I try to get involved with making changes out here. You know, every chance I get, anything I can get involved with to pursue my passion with making changes so that people like myself and people, you know, that have been through what I've been through don't have to go through those things again, you know. So that's pretty much it.
Great. I always ask the same last question. What question should I have asked but did not? What would you have liked to talk about that I didn't get to? If anything.
What question? I'd just say, what's my favorite sports team? I don't know.
That's fine. We're a sports friendly podcast here at Decarceration Nation. So,
well, I'll tell you this: I'm a big Detroit fan, you know. So I'm a fan of the Pistons, Lions, Red Wings, and Tigers. I got on a Raiders jersey right now just because it looks good. I think Raiders jerseys look good on everybody. But I'm a big Detroit fan, and I'm a proud Detroiter. I'm proud of where Detroit is right now. I am so proud. And this today, the passing of this law, the enactment of this law, it's representative of the forward movement that Detroit as a city and Michigan as a state is going forward into. And I'm just proud. Today is a very proud day in Detroit. There's so many people that are excited. And we all, Michigan is a blue collar state and with some hardworking people. And, you know, it's just good to know that this was a concerted effort that in terms of enacting this law. And I just want to thank all the people that really, really came together to put this together. I really do.
Well, thanks so much, man. It's really good to, really nice to get to talk to you, and I really appreciate you doing this.
You as well. You as well, Joshua. I thank you for reaching out to me, and I appreciate it. And I heard so much about the show. You have a wonderful show, and hopefully I can come on back again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll make sure and put a link to your book in the show notes too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I definitely appreciate that.
All right, brother. You have a good one, and very nice meeting you.
All right. You as well. You have a wonderful day.
Chief Justice Bridget Mary McCormick joined the Michigan Supreme Court in January 2013 and became Chief Justice in January 2019. Before her election to the court in November 2012, she was a law professor and dean at the University of Michigan Law School. She is a graduate of New York University Law School. She spent the first 5 years of her legal career in New York, first with the Legal Aid Society and then with the Office of the Appellate Defender. In 1996, she became a faculty fellow at the Yale Law School. In 2008, then Associate Dean McCormick co-founded the Michigan Innocence Clinic, in which students represent wrongfully convicted Michiganders. The clinic has exonerated over 15 people so far, maybe more since last I wrote this down, and has shined a light on the important justice issues underlying wrongful conviction. In 2018, the Michigan Association for Justice honored Chief Justice McCormick with its Judicial Excellence Award, and Chief Justice McCormick will also be the 2021 recipient of the Milliken Award, awarded annually by Safe and Just Michigan. Welcome back to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Chief Justice McCormick.
It is great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I always start with the same first question, and it's kind of the comic book origin story question. How did you get from wherever you started in life to where you became the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court? That's a big one.
It's a big question, and it's I have sort of like a unusual path. I am not somebody who went to law school to be a judge. In fact, I don't think I ever thought about being a judge until about a year before I ran for office. In fact, you know, if someone went to law school to be a judge, they probably would not have spent most of their career representing people accused of crimes. That's not usually the path to the bench.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. It's, I think, more diversity on our bench is a good thing. But through a series of unusual events, I ended up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, teaching at the University of Michigan Law School, go blue. And there was an open seat on the Michigan Supreme Court, and I had an appellate practice where I was in that court quite a bit and had good relationships with the justices, and people started talking to me about thinking about running, and I think because I was naive enough to do it, I did it, and then I was elected, and so there I was. But I spent most of my career as a lawyer representing people who couldn't afford lawyers, and that was what I cared about, thought about, wrote about, and thought I would always do. So it was not a well thought through career path for me, but here I am.
And what took you to the law in the first place? How did you end up in the place where you even getting to represent? What was the real origin of your journey?
Yeah, good question. I have a big family. I mean, my immediate family is not that big, just a brother and sister, but I have like dozens and dozens of first cousins. And I don't have a single other person in my family who is a lawyer. So it wasn't a path that was well paved for me. However, my godmother, I was always quite close to. I think she didn't have kids of her own. And I think I therefore got like special godmother attention. Like, I think both my siblings had one of my aunts who had a gazillion kids of their own. And so they couldn't even keep track of who their godkids were. But my godmother was played a big role in my life. And she lived in New York City. I grew up in New Jersey. And she was a legal aid lawyer. And I would go into the city and spend a couple of days with her and go to work with her. And I really think that was probably the most formative relationship for me in thinking about the law as a tool for helping people in our communities.
Traditionally, task forces in politics are kind of, at least everybody always says, are where good ideas go to die. That did not happen with the task force on jail and pretrial incarceration in Michigan. Can you remind everyone about how it came about and was created, and what kind of, in your opinion, made it different than the traditional task force that we see nothing come out of in a lot of other parts of the country?
Yeah, the Michigan Joint Task Force on Jail and Pretrial Incarceration is quite a success story, and one that I'm particularly proud of, not necessarily for my own work on it, but just the work that so many people did to contribute to it. But to remind everybody about how it came to be, all three branches of government, the leaders in the legislature, the governor, and I, together with the county sheriffs and the Michigan Association from Counties, entered into a joint agreement with the Pew Charitable Trust to help us collect and understand data about what was driving Michigan's county jail populations. Now, stepping back even a little bit further, Michigan's county jail populations, like many other states, this didn't make us special, really, had tripled over the last 30 years, even though crime was at a 50-year low. And lots of people had ideas about why that was, but they were mostly anecdotal. They were not evidence-based because we did not have a system for collecting data to understand what was driving those jail populations. But there was enough interest given the cost of jails and the fact that nobody was really confident that the rising jail populations was really contributing to public safety, that we wanted to figure it out and see if there were smarter policies once we could understand that data. What made it so successful is a harder question. I think that having Pew staff it was a huge part of the success. It is not that often that you get that many talented analysts helping you collect and analyze the data and organizing stakeholders around the state so that we were really including every voice. And frankly, the Pew has done a great publication on the task force process, which maybe you should link to in your show notes here, because I think that tells the story quite well for folks who are interested in looking at the model. But I think the ways in which we made sure the task force itself included every stakeholder, and then the hard work, talking to the public, hearing from the public, throughout the process, were big parts of the success. And then I have to hand it to the legislative leaders. I mean, we delivered the task force delivered its recommendations in January of 2020, and we all know, you know, what happened a couple of months later. And the legislative leaders decided they were still going to make it a priority to make sure that they acted on those recommendations. And that, I think, was a much heavier lift in the middle of a pandemic, and they did it.
Yeah, I can definitely say, as somewhat of a fringe player, but who is present for the entire task force process, it's, you know, the Pew people did a great job. I've gotten to know almost all of them over that period, and it is pretty impressive. The last time you were on the podcast, almost 2 years ago, none of the task force bills had yet passed. You hadn't even made your recommendations at that time. Can you summarize some of the recommendations the task force made that would really, or in the process of, as a lot of them just became active in October 1st, really made to reduce jail populations?
Yeah, the task force recommendations kind of fell into three buckets: a set of recommendations that were aimed at the arrest phase of, you know, when people end up in jail, a set of recommendations that were aimed at the pretrial phase, and then a set of recommendations aimed at the post-conviction phase, because we learned once we collected the data in Michigan that while half of the people in Michigan's county jails were not convicted, half were convicted, and some serving time for violations of probation and parole that were sort of technical violations. So we sort of felt like we needed recommendations to address each of those different parts of the process that was contributing to our jail populations. And a number of those, as you said, have already now been enacted into law. Yes, when we last spoke, we didn't even have the recommendations together yet, but since then, a lot has gone on. So last session, the legislature passed and the governor signed legislation that expanded officer discretion to use appearance tickets as an alternative to arrest in jail, legislation that reduced the use of arrest warrants to enforce court appearances and payments, legislation to presume sentences other than jail for most misdemeanors and some felonies, and legislation to shorten probation terms and limit jail time for technical probation violations. And finally, the biggest set of reforms that have just come online in the last couple of days are a series of bills that stop suspending and revoking driver's licenses for actions that have nothing to do with driving safety. We were shocked when we learned how many people were going to Michigan jails because of a suspended driver's license. And so there was a very broad agreement that was something we could do something about and it would make a big difference.
As someone who testified on citations in lieu of arrests at the task force, I'm particularly happy that some of those things have come to law. Many of the recommendations, as you just mentioned, were passed last year. That's got to be, you know, I mean, I've been involved, you know, with a certain number of things that have passed. It's always an interesting process. What were your kind of takeaways from the whole kind of how this happened, what happened, where we're at, and how you feel now about it?
You know, honestly, it was really an honor to be part of this particular process because it felt like, even where there was some disagreement, which of course there always will be when you have diverse viewpoints around a table, everyone was pretty committed to getting something important done, you know, and we felt like Michigan was a good place to show the country that there are actually still policy issues that Republicans and Democrats can agree about and do something about. And Michigan, I think, has this great track record for bipartisan criminal justice reform. And so this was a wonderful I think, chapter in that story, and one it was really an honor to be a part of. I'm not, you know, the judiciary has important information for the other branches of government as they think about policy. I mean, sometimes we, in fact, have the most important information. So I think making us a partner in figuring out how to make these changes was a really good idea, and a model that I hope we continue as we look at some of the other places where reform is still on the table.
You mentioned a couple seconds ago the driver's license suspensions and reforms to that. That reform just went into effect on October 1st, and today's October 4th. Earlier during this episode, I was able to talk to Kamal Lukata Anderson, who was directly impacted by license suspensions during his lifetime. From your perspective, why was it particularly important for the task force to focus on the issue of driver's license suspensions? And what do you think that's going to mean for our state going forward?
Yeah, this is a set of reforms that I'm especially excited about. It was really stunning how many people, as I said, were spending time in Michigan jails because their driver's license had been suspended, and not because they were charged with reckless driving or driving under the influence, but instead because they had been unable to pay a fine or a fee in some other case that had nothing to do with driving safety. And this was a quick area of agreement for most of us that that doesn't make a lot of sense. Probably doesn't make a lot of sense most places, but here in Michigan, we drive to work. There are some communities where we have some bus routes. I live in Washtenaw County, and parts of Washtenaw County has excellent buses. Not where I live. I can't get a bus if I want to. If I'm going to get to my work, I'm going to have to get in my car. And if we're taking people's ability to drive away from them because they are unable to pay a fine or a fee, it's very clearly counterproductive, because you probably want them to be able to get to work so they can pay that fine or fee. So this felt like sort of an easy area for policy agreement. What was shocking was how many people were impacted by it. About 350,000 people in Michigan each year had their license suspended for these reasons that have nothing to do with driving safety. So the reforms that came online on Friday, October 1st, automatically restored driver's licenses to tens of thousands of people and made a bunch of others eligible. But going forward, it's that amount, that, you know, 350,000 a year who will be able to continue to get to work and therefore pay their outstanding obligations and their child support and their taxes. And, you know, our employers need them at work. So I think this set of reforms is one that will have a tremendous impact throughout the state, not just on those individuals and their families, but our workforce and our communities.
And I think it's interesting because so many people, you know, even if I were just listening to this for the first time, I don't think it would occur to me that driver's license suspensions unrelated to traffic, to actually causing harm, are one of the largest drivers of incarceration in our state. It's just crazy that was the case. And it's so good to see so many people potentially getting relief.
It's a really important change. In the Wayne County Jail, it was the single highest reason people were entering the Wayne County Jail. But statewide, it was the third highest reason people were going to jail. That's, I don't know. I'm glad we did something about it.
I totally agree. It's an amazing accomplishment. Can you also talk about the work you are doing with the Jail Reform Advisory Council to ensure the laws are implemented properly after all this stuff passed, and that the data, because one of the big problems that we also noticed, I think, throughout the process of the task force is there's a lot of problems with coordination between different systems and different counties and things like that to make sure that these laws are implemented properly and data is tracked going forward.
Yeah. So one of the recommendations, in fact, the last recommendation, last but not at all least, of the task force was to invest and engage in robust criminal justice data collection going forward, not just to be able to get a sense of how these reforms are performing, but for, you know, a million other reasons. Without good data, it's hard to know whether policies that we pass are having the impact we hope they will have. So the Jail Reform Advisory Council, the governor set up and appointed me to chair, has all of the system stakeholders represented, and we meet monthly to discuss how the reforms are working so far and what data we can collect, and then how we can figure out what to do with it so that we can report back to the governor and the legislature, as well as the court, about how these reforms are working out in practice. It's one thing to get the data to be able to make smart decisions about reforms, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to put those in place and then never look again at how they're doing. So this this advisory council is charged with doing exactly that.
You talked a little bit earlier about kind of some of the top level people who are involved, like Pew, and some of the, like the governor and the leadership of the House and the Senate. But there were so many people involved at all different levels throughout the process, you know, everyone from people like me to activists to people coming from across the state to show up at the meetings to tell their stories. Can you talk about how the task force incorporated everyone from all those folks to task force members to sheriffs, prosecutors, victim advocacy groups, all these folks, and brought them under the tent and made sure that everything was kind of incorporated in the final result?
Yeah, in addition to the task force itself having really diverse stakeholder representation, as you said, in addition to the three branches of government, we had police and sheriffs and prosecutors and defense attorneys and people impacted by crime and people who were who spent time in jail. And those voices were important at the task force table. But in addition to that, the task force met over the course of its existence repeatedly with stakeholders in focus groups and roundtables to get even more information. And at each public task force meeting, we made lots of time for public testimony. And that was frankly incredibly impactful. We heard at those sessions from people who worked in the system, people who had gotten caught up in the system, people who had survived terrible things and not felt always completely supported by the current system. And that sort of qualitative evidence was you know, almost as impactful as the quantitative evidence. It really was. And I think it was, it made an important impression on all of us that the work we were doing was important, right? There were people who had experienced this system from every direction, who definitely saw room for improvement, right? If there was one thing that people agreed about, it was we were on the right track to try and figure out smarter policies for jails.
We still have some recommendations of the task force outstanding, and we're starting to see those pretty soon in the next couple of weeks, probably. Start their path through the legislative process. Could you summarize some of these last bills and talk about what you think the impact that they could have what might be?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of, I would say there's sort of two different buckets of bills, and the first concern behavioral health issues. One of the things we learned, which didn't surprise any of us, was how often jails become the de facto mental health and substance abuse like treatment location for a community because there's nowhere else for people to take people suffering a crisis. And that's frankly unfair to the police officers and the deputy sheriffs who are charged with those crises. So there are two bills that have been introduced in the Senate, Senate Bill 637 and Senate Bill 638, if anybody wants to follow them, along with funding in the budget that would create a grant program for counties to either create, if they don't have one, or expand jail diversion programs for people with behavioral health challenges. As I said, we heard so much testimony about jails being the place where people went who were suffering these crises, and obviously that's not necessarily the best price. So this is this grant program will be a way to experiment with different ways of handling people who are suffering mental health crises and behavioral health crises. There's a second package of bills, pretrial bills, that's planned for introduction in the House, I believe, early this month. These are the bills that will focus on pretrial incarceration. They're designed to protect public safety and safeguard liberty for people who are presumed innocent. And the task force found that about half of people in our county jails are presumed innocent, and many are there for low-level offenses for which they simply can't pay bond. And there's really good national research now that even a few days in jail will have lasting negative effects on people in terms of housing, families, and even recidivism. So these bills have bipartisan sponsors. They've been vetted by diverse stakeholders, including prosecutors, judges, law enforcement, victims, advocates, and they will, to summarize, I think, allow most people arrested for low-level offenses to be released from jail quickly without paying money and get them back to work, back to their families, and detain only people with serious offenses or those who pose a safety or a flight risk when that's important. So the hope is that these will be a smarter approach to pretrial.
You know, you talked about a little bit earlier about how Michigan's had a lot of success with bipartisanship and criminal justice reform. And we've seen some of that at the national level, too, recently over the last several years. But is there something, you know, having been through it and working with both sides of the aisle to help see a lot of this stuff happen, is there anything you've seen that, you know, I mean, we're in the middle of a national dialogue where it seems like there's a million things we can never find a way to work together on. How is it that we've been able to continue, or what are your reflections on how we've been able to move forward with so much in a state that is very divided politically, even if we are able to come together on these issues?
Yeah, Michigan really does have quite a story to tell on bipartisan criminal justice reform. And honestly, I bet there are people who are more eloquent about that history than I am. I will say that the criminal legal system, you know, has impacted most of us at this point, right? It's not, you know, what we learned from the data we collected is that rural jails have, their jail populations in rural communities have outpaced, their growth has outpaced jails in suburban and urban communities. So the ways in which people are getting caught up in the county jail system cross every kind of demographic. And I think lots of people with maybe differences of opinions on other policy questions have seen that we can probably do better with how we think about what we're doing to achieve public safety. And I think people come to the table with maybe, you know, different first principles for getting there, but they have more in common than not on these issues. And I think the track record helps. I think having achieved some big wins in terms of expungement and some other areas, it feels like something we can get done. And so people seem eager to do it. And again, I really have to credit my partners in the other branches of government. The lieutenant governor, by the way, was an unbelievable co-chair, really put like all kinds of time into getting this task force to a place where we could actually see some real reform. And the leaders in the legislature really stepped up. And so I hope lots of people will try in other states will want to learn about what we did here in Michigan. I mean, we're still doing it, but what we've gotten done so far.
This season, I've been asking people to share their favorite criminal justice related books. Do you have any favorites you'd like to share?
I mean, I think you probably know the books that I've read recently, you probably have talked to all of the authors. So Rachel Lurko's book, I think you've probably had Rachel on, but I think her book is an excellent one. I loved Daniel Surratt's book.
Prisoners of Politics is the...
Prisoners of Politics, yeah. I'm sorry, is a wonderful, wonderful book. And, you know, even though Rachel is a very successful legal academic. It's written for, you don't have to be a legal scholar to read it and understand it. And I love that when law professors can write books for regular people, which I think Rachel did well. I love Daniel Sered's book, When We Reckon. And I think it's a really important contribution to how we're gonna think about the next steps in criminal legal system reform. And Emily Bazelon's book, Charged, I think is a wonderful book, because I think when you tell real stories about real people, it impacts us in a way that sticks with us. So those are three that I've enjoyed, and I think you know all those folks.
Yeah, I'm feeling patting myself on the back, because I have had all three of them on to talk about those books. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. I always ask the same last question. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but did not?
I can't think of anything you messed up at all.
Well, I like to at least pretend a little bit of humility in these things. You know,
fair enough.
Take a minute. But if there's anything else you'd like to talk about, or anything else that you're thinking about that people, or not, you know, I just always put it out there.
I will tell you, there's one thing that I'm, the pandemic has brought more change to courts and legal systems in 18 months than in, you know, a century, literally. I mean, courtrooms in February 2020 looked a lot like they did in 1918, the last time we had a pandemic. Nothing has changed. And we've learned so much about access to justice that we wouldn't have learned but for the pandemic. And in particular, the civil legal system, where most people who have really important problems can't afford lawyers. 8 out of 10 people can't afford lawyers. We've seen incredible results in defaults going way down when people are able to access courts with remote platforms. We can't turn away from that. And I've been thinking a lot lately about all of the overlap between the civil legal system, where people can't afford lawyers but end up losing the place where they live, or, you know, their family. These are important legal issues, even if jail isn't involved. But there's so much overlap between the people who have to manage the criminal legal system, where at least they get a lawyer if they can't afford one, and the civil legal system. And the people working on both sets of problems, I want talking to each other more. So there's one thought that I've been having a lot lately, for whatever it's worth.
And do you feel like there's anything you've learned from the process? You've been involved in trying to technologically modernize and equalize the court access to the courts for a long time. Is there anything you've seen through the pandemic specifically that people might learn from or might take to other court systems from Michigan?
One thing that I think is a you know, sort of a stunning fact that we just can't turn away from is how many people who used to default when they had to go to a physical courthouse to defend, say, an eviction or a debt collection case, and no longer do default, is when they have a remote option, is something we're just going to have to reckon with going forward. You know, if access is important to us, and in my view, it's fundamental to the rule of law that everybody is able to access their legal system, then we're going to have to keep what we've learned about democratizing access. But I don't think it's enough just to take traditional court and put it onto a Zoom screen. I mean, it's not nothing. We've learned it's not nothing. In fact, it's something important in a lot of ways. But we're at a moment right now where we're going to have to think, I think, broader and bigger about what we might do to transform access to justice. We've never really done much other than sort of nibble at it around the edges. And we have a chance now to do some, I think, bigger things.
That's very exciting. Thanks so much for doing this, Chief Justice, and for all your work with the task force and everything else, and for just spending some time with us today. Thanks again for doing this.
It's my pleasure. I love any time I get to talk to you.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
And now, my take. In 2019, the Department of Justice released a report on the crisis in Alabama prisons, finding that the Alabama Department of Corrections had violated the Eighth Amendment rights of people incarcerated in their prisons. Why? because they were not protecting the people in their care from violence and abuse, and because they were not providing a safe environment for the people incarcerated in their care. In addition, Alabama's prisons were overcrowded, holding over 182% above capacity. 1 year after that first report was released, a second report was released by the DOJ finding the Alabama Department of Corrections employees routinely used excessive force against the people incarcerated in their prisons. They found that physical assaults, often involving the use of batons and chemical spray, were routine and frequently intentional. For some inexplicable reason, the governor and legislature of Alabama have decided that the answer to this problem is to build several new private prison facilities, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. To many of us on the reform side, it seems unclear how building new prisons makes the correctional officers more responsible and less reprehensible, how it makes the standard of care higher, or how it changes the broken and violent culture so omnipresent that even the Trump Justice Department found it to be beyond the pale. I can only pray that somehow this works out and makes one of the worst and most violent prison systems in the United States safer for the people incarcerated in Alabama. I can't for the life of me figure out how this will change the culture, result in the hiring of more correctional officers, or ensure that those officers protect the people placed in their care. But I will pray that happens so that our brothers and sisters inside those prisons can be safer. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or who have given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or at us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Ann Asmo for helping with our transcripts and social media images, and to Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on your social media and share our posts across your networks. Also thanks to my employer Safe and Just Michigan for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.